Good morning, and thank you for joining us this October 7th at 7:05. And you are listening to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Ted Maxwell. Behind the glass with me today is Matt Neely again, keeping me on time and target. Matt, appreciate having you back there.
Good morning, Ted.
The Morning Voice, 5 days a week, five different hosts. Lydia Aranda on Monday, Grant Kruger with Food for Thought on Wednesdays, Tom Moulton talking everything attractions and activities going on, and then the wonder of the University of Arizona, as well as successful businesses with Ed Ackerley on Friday. And Lydia Randall on Monday, of course, is Rainmakers.
Had a rip-roaring show yesterday. The podcast is up. The video's up on YouTube, 1030 The Voice is our channel. The podcast is up at KBOI. It was a fast-moving, interesting, and fun show yesterday.
Well, it's always good to hear that. And Matt, I really want to say thank you and appreciate how you really promote The Morning Voice and KVOI, 1030 The Voice as well. I know you were out at the football game this weekend.
Yes.
Which was yeoman's work for a couple of reasons. One, it was earlier than a normal start time. And two, it was hot. It's October.
It was a warm day. 1030 The Voice was fortunate to be out there at the Bear Down Field. We were there with our sister stations, The Groove, 106.3 The Groove, and La Poderosa and Urbana, and we were meeting people at the tailgate, celebrating Hispanic heritage and listening to some fine music by a band called The Johns and a favorite of yours and mine, Roger Klein and the Peacemakers. So it was hardly qualifies as work. It was a lot of fun meeting people out there.
That's true. It was a incredible event. A lot of good music.
Thanks to everybody who stopped by.
A lot of good thing going on. I think that was the largest, to me, as I recall, of probably a decade plus of watching, of going to the football games. It was the largest mariachi and dancers ever I've seen on the field.
Else.
It was huge. I mean, it covered the entire side of the field. It was truly amazing on that front.
Yes, it was really special at halftime. And the pregame, they performed on the stage in between bands. You know, they had people come up and speak, including Rob Gronkowski, who spiked a football for everybody. But they had some mariachi bands take the stage and perform there in between the other bands. Yeah, it was good.
There's no doubt that Gronk.
Maybe the mariachi band. Excuse me. Maybe the mariachi band said we had a couple of other bands perform between our groups. I mean,
that they absolutely did. You know, it's. I'd love to go back and take a look at how we do on Hispanic Heritage Day for our games, because that game on Saturday was a well-played University of Arizona football game.
Sure it was. They gave up one touchdown in garbage time late in the second half, but it was a good effort on both sides of the ball, I thought.
The defense, I think, has really been setting the tone in a lot of ways. I mean, they're swarming. They're all over the place. They don't stop. They continue to grind. We've got some tough games coming up. BYU's obviously coming to town.
Oklahoma State's not at the top of their game right now, but it was a good effort, and I think – you know, hopefully it shows that the team's in a good space entering a tough game this weekend against
BYU. That is 5 o'clock down there. Get down, support the game, support the Cats. You know, a huge day. Pepita had 375 plus yards, 5 touchdowns. I mean, Trey Spivey's opening offensive surge with the 2 touchdown passes that were just amazing plays was just incredible. It started off right and it kept rolling. I hope the Big 12 did learn one lesson. Early in October, 12 o'clock might not be a good start time for the game, because there was no doubt you could see it in the crowd. You could see it in the stadium. Everybody was under anywhere there was shade.
Game well in hand by halftime in the student section, pretty much emptied out after halftime. So it was a little toasty out there and a lot of sun and oh my goodness. So I mean, sadly, when the TV networks say jump, we say how high. We'd play an 8 a.m. game if they told us to, and start tailgating on the mall at 2 in the morning, which may not be a bad idea.
Hey, that might be a first, and that would actually be pretty impressive. You know, those morning games are good. The tailgating becomes a breakfast more than anything else.
Kegs
that
and
can
eggs,
be fun.
Baby. Yep.
You know, 8:30 at night, that's okay. It's just hard to keep everybody in the stadium sometimes when you pick those midday games or you pick the super late games. Yeah. You just especially if even in this case, you know, it's you always stay to the end, stay to the fourth quarter. That's the mantra. But man, it's tough to do when it's that hot.
I've always thought if you once you get to October, a six p.m. start is nice, and then in November, do the four p.m. p.m. starts.
Absolutely,
and just enjoy the afternoon. But anyway, we're in a different world now, and we are at the whim of a TV schedule.
The nation got to see the Cats on ESPN2, so that was good. They got to see some good football, and I think anybody should be ecstatic right now with the improvement we've seen in the team. 4-1 at this point. I don't know if anybody would have expected that.
And night and day from last year, a new offensive coordinator, new defensive coordinator. I like what I'm seeing so far.
It's a change of attitude is what I've seen. So we've got a great show today. We are going to focus locally today. When we come back after the break, Matt and I are going to talk about some of the things going on in the city politics. If you're a registered voter for the city of Tucson election, your ballot will be mailed tomorrow, and tomorrow is the first day for early voting allowed. So we'll kind of cover a little bit of that. We'll cover a little bit of what's going on with the bus unions. There were some announcements there, and we've got a little bit of setup on some talk of Tucson, and then at the bottom of the hour, J.L. Wittenbraker, candidate for Ward 3 for the city council, will come on with us for 30 minutes. First time we've had her on the show. And then at the top of the hour, at the 8 o'clock hour, Laura Conover, the Pima County county attorney, will join us to talk about a lot of the different things. It's one of those ones I've reached out and worked hard to get her to come in. I want her to have an opportunity to tell us from her position the challenges and how things are going, and maybe explain some of the things that I say most of us who work somewhere in the media or in public policy or in things, what we see is not good coming out of the office. So I look forward to her coming on and giving her a chance to speak and tell us what's going on. So at this point, we're going to go to our first break. Stay around. Matt and I will talk things going on in Tucson when we come back from the break. You're listening to 1030 The Voice, your trusted local news and talk station. Welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Ted Maxwell, on Engagement Tuesdays. One of the most important responsibilities and rights we have as citizens of the United States is to vote. And so that kind of leads us into the conversation that starting tomorrow, ballots will go out for Tucson voters. And it's kind of interesting because depending where you live, you may have some different issues on the ballot. But the one thing everyone will have will be for three Ward, will be electing council members.
Ward 3, Ward 5, Ward 6.
Ward 3, Ward 5, and Ward 6. Ward 5, Selena Barajas will be on the, will be on the ballot. She has already won that seat, did not have a primary, but defeated two other candidates in the, or she had a primary.
Yes.
But doesn't have a general. No,
correct.
No Republican or member of another party decided to run in Ward 5, but she did defeat two other candidates in the Ward 4 primary. And then you will have Ward 3, with our guest this at the bottom of the half hour, Janet J.L. Wittenbraker, will be running against current sitting city councilman Kevin Dahl, who did have a primary and was extremely close. And he defeated Sadie Shaw by 19 votes.
Yeah, 19 votes, folks. Your vote counts.
So every vote counts, and that's why it's not only your right, and it's your responsibility. Do it and be educated when you vote. Ward 6 is the other district. The third and final council race is in Ward 6, and that spans the area around the university and downtown. But remember, this election is a citywide.
Thank you, Dad.
So it does not matter what ward you live in.
Right.
It doesn't matter what part of Tucson you live in. Under the system, which I may not like, but under this system, everybody in the city gets to elect who gets to represent these three wards.
Correct.
So
that's citywide voting. If you live in the city of Tucson, you get to vote. So do so.
It's your best way to affect change, either of thought, of mind, or of the people in the seats. So get out there, do what you are expected to do to be part of a representative form of government. You need to vote. 20% of the voters in CD7 in that special election voted.
Right.
And that to me is the sign that the democracy is beginning to fail. It's troubling if the citizens don't feel they should be involved. Your vote can make a difference, so get out and vote. And by the way, you won't just be voting on those three things. Plan Tucson is the 10-year update of the general plan. The city is required by state law to do that. So Prop 417 will be on there. You can find that information on the city website if you're curious of what goes into it.
Okay.
But it's required to get approval from the city. If it fails, it will be back on the ballot probably in about a year. They may make some changes, and you'll do that and go there. And then the other thing that you're going to have to vote on, there's, depending what school district you are in, you will be voting either in a TUSD budget override. Flowing Wells is they're asking Prop 414 will be allowed TUSD's board to override the budget by 15%. And Flowing Wells is going to have a bond initiative on their ballot for a $30 million bond plan. That's Prop 415, and it allows Flowing Wells to fund a number of projects, including safety, security at schools, replacing portable buildings that are currently being used for classroom, and then also before and after school programs, as well as some other issues. And if you're in Sunnyside, you also will be facing a bond and a decision, and that's a $120 million bond. It would raise the secondary property tax in that case by 0.93 cents per $100 of net assessed valuation. That's Prop 416. It will be used to for construction and renovations at all 21 of their schools and their grounds, including replacing buildings at Sunnyside High School. So you can get more information if you go to www.schools.pima.gov elections. And you can find all the information on those three if you wish to as well there.
Yeah, it's your chance to affirm the direction and the arc of the city, or ask that we make a course correction. So it's your choice. If you think everything's going great, you know how to vote. And if you want to change that arc, you know how to vote. And people have the power, Ted.
And they do. They actually do. And sometimes I think we forget that.
Yes.
And people think in the city of Tucson, no, it's all baked. No, it's not. Elections happen.
Right.
The votes are counted, and those folks who get the most votes are elected. So if you either agree with the current direction of the city council or want to see changes, you have to get out and vote. And yesterday, speaking of people who want to see changes that occur, yesterday, the Teamsters Union, I believe 104,
I believe is the
held a press conference, and that's the union that represents SunTran, and it was a press conference held by SunTran bus drivers, and they really made a really strong case for why they believe something needs to be done about the violence on the buses. And it's pretty, you know, when you think about it, we hear about it all the time. They talk about it, but when the drivers themselves are out telling you what's occurred, and they got up and made a strong case that something needs to be done.
Right.
Now, right. Immediately. One of the speakers there was a bus driver who 18 months ago was hit over the head with a fire hydrant.
Fire extinguisher.
Or fire extinguisher. Fire hydrant would have been
Don't but try fire that at home. It hurts.
Has not been able to come back to first, but they went on and even said previous SunTran incidents that they brought up. On April 5th, 25-year-old Daniel Michael Jr. allegedly attacked a man and woman with a hatchet at the Sunlink streetcar stop in downtown Tucson. That was the one that resulted in the death of a visitor to our town, Jacob Couch.
Mm-hmm.
On May 12th, April 5th. May 12th, 42-year-old Frank Rick Lopez allegedly attacked two people with a hatchet at a SunTran bus stop near Sabino Canyon.
Udall Park.
In Tanca Verde. On July 9th, 15-year-old woman was arrested after a 19-year-old woman was injured during a knife fight. Matter of fact, that one, I believe, was caught on video.
Yep.
And that was on a bus near the Ronstadt Center. August 11th, a man was injured in a stabbing at the Ronstadt Center downtown. August 12th, a man was injured in a fight and a stabbing at the Los Transit Center. Transit Center in Tucson. August 20th, a man was injured in a fight and stabbing at the Tohono T'odai Transit Center near the Tucson Mall.
Mm-hmm.
September 9th, SunTran driver was injured in assault at Utah Park.
One of these was as a Symphonic Winds in the Park concert was going on. It was either the hatchet or this one you just mentioned. Hundreds of people were a few hundred yards away enjoying a concert in the park.
And just yesterday, an elderly man was injured in an assault at a SunTran bus stop at Pantano and Stella.
Yep.
So they go on, and Reyna was the name of the bus driver who has not been back to work since she was hit. Mm-hmm. They did got very vocal. And the question is, so now what's the city going to do? I mean, there's options. I might be one of those that would say, let's reinstate the fares. The thing that has changed, and what they brought up at the conference, was what has changed is not necessarily, it's just been who's riding the bus. Mm-hmm. They acknowledge that there are more folks that ride the bus all day. They aren't riding the
bus.
They're
not going any particular place.
Exactly.
They're getting air conditioning.
Open drug use.
Yeah.
Open alcohol. You know, does that occur on every bus every day? No, of course it doesn't. There's probably some bus routes that are safer than others. But the challenge that you've got from the driver's perspective is you've changed who's riding the bus, and more importantly, the ability to impact their future ability to ride the bus. We have no way of tracking anybody. The bus drivers are still told not to engage mm-hmm. physically with the riders. And so far, the city has not expressed any concern of making a difference.
The mayor has told you that you're ludicrous if you're trying to, you see with your own two eyes, you've been gaslighted by the city for 5 years. They've obstinately clung to these, to no fare bus rides, right? Obstinately clung to this since COVID, since they initiated it during COVID to, quote, help people. And spoiler alert, they're not helping people. Right? They are not help. Free bus rides were available to people with financial need before they instituted this system that has been an abject failure. And the city and the mayor even said it in Stellar's column. She said about a week ago, she says, we've been doing the same thing for the last 6 years. We're trying to find people services, get people connected with services and resources. And she admitted, that's an admission that what she's done and she and her council have done for 6 years is a failure.
And I think this is part of the conversation we'll get in with Laura Conover later today is, when you do the same thing time and time again, and don't get any right. different results, that's the definition of insanity, right?
There was a guy on Harrison. He assaulted a school kid at a bus stop.
Right.
Right. And I've got to look up the story, but I kind of think that maybe the guy didn't have any consequences for that act. In the back of my mind, I thought I saw a follow up on that story.
It was interesting.
He's a school kid, man.
Yeah, 14-year-old trying to get to band practice.
Yeah. That was that one too on 29th Street. Yeah.
So the Teamsters Local 104 treasurer and secretary Carla Schulman said, "Open illicit drug use is a major cause of the violence operators sure. face." For weeks, she pointed out that for weeks Tucson leaders have been discussing a new way to combat public drug use. Mm-hmm. Well, they wanted. They'd like them to also consider combating the problem of allowing that drug use on the bus. Yeah. They, as she went on to say, what we have isn't working. It's not safe, and it's got to change. They acknowledge it's not going to be a simple solution, but it's a systematic problem. It's not a one-stop fix. Multiple facets, multiple layers. They want to be part of the problem. And right now, when the union steps up and makes this kind of statement publicly, a union that predominantly is supportive of those in office, when they're making a statement publicly, that means like they feel they are not being heard.
Mm-hmm.
So the union, interestingly, I think has gone a step farther. You said it in the news coverage. Mm-hmm. I've been trying to find exactly where it is, but the transit union, or more importantly, the International Teamsters mm-hmm. Union, so my understanding nationwide, came out as endorsed Jay Tolkoff in that district, or that Ward 6 race.
And I think it's a safe move for them because it's an open seat. Because I'm like, well, why wouldn't they endorse change in Ward 3? Well, there's somebody in office. But Ward 6, I think they're looking at that as an open seat, so that's safe for them to step out and make an endorsement like that.
And I do believe Ward 6, if you look at it, Miranda Schubert, who at some point I want to try to get her on the radio as well, she's a very strong transit advocate.
I see.
Very, very strong, a very strong free fare advocate.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if Jay, I can't remember, I don't believe he's taken a definite position on whether he'd be free fares or returning to fares, but he is very strong about wanting to change something on the bus system as well. And that kind of changes the posture in that election. Again, sure, it goes back to why your votes are important. Because to have an organization like the Teamsters, a union, come out and endorse a Republican candidate in a citywide election is kind of different. Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure when the last time we've seen that in this region.
I'll put a real fine point on it. Rahina and her associates on the city council and the people she endorses and her tribe, her fellow travelers, they broke it. They own it. That's it, man. That's it. It's 5 years of stubbornly doing this. They broke it. They own it.
And the thing is, I truly believe that there's a solution other than reinstating fares. I think there's multiple reasons you should reinstate fares, but one of them is accountability to who's riding the bus. The other one, and remember, 43%, I believe, of the riders in the past used to have either discounted or free fares even before they went free fare. Universal. The other way is to instill a pass system. It's going to cost money. It's going to take time.
They but if you're pass not, system. If they did have a pass system.
If you're not tracking if you're not tracking who's riding, you can't address those who are creating the problems. Especially if you're saying it's a minority of people creating the problems, then let's get them off the buses. Let's support our drivers and make good decisions. So enough on that topic. When we come back, we'll be with J.L. Wittenbraker, candidate for Ward 3. You're listening to 1030 The Voice, your trusted local news and talk. Welcome back. Thank you for staying with us on The Morning Voice. I'm Ted Maxwell, Matt Neely behind the glass. And I'm pleased to welcome Janet J.L. Wittenbraker with us this morning, the Republican candidate for Ward 3 for the city council in Tucson. Good morning, JL. Glad to have you on the radio with me.
Well, thank you for having me. And I got to tell you, Ted, you are quite possibly the only person who says my name correctly every single time. Thank you.
Well, I'm glad. I'll take that as a positive. And I believe you prefer to go by JL, so that's probably how I'll refer to you today, unless you'd rather me go by Janet or future council member, or you know, however you want it. We can go down that path. So I appreciate you taking the time to be with us today.
Great. Let's stick with the JL. You know, after all, I'm just a regular gal who took a look around my city and said, I don't like this, and it's time to get busy. And that's what I'm doing.
And I know that's what you're doing. You've been trying to do that. You've been more than involved in the community in the last several years. You ran for mayor. You've run for District 3, and you are intent on improving your community. So why don't you give the listeners who may not be aware of who you are a little bit of your background and why you decided you wanted to run for Ward 3.
So I am a contracts professional. I've been in the contracts industry, specifically with the defense industry, for over a decade. I have a master's in legal studies from Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law. I am a member of large at the with the Republican Party. And I was previously employed by the city manager's office. And it was during this employment that I realized what happens in your local government has more of an effect on your daily life than any other political spectrum. What happens in Tucson is impacting the lives of over a million people. And for that reason, I went on, this is the funny part, right? So I realized that, and I went on to my daily life, my daily commute, and it finally just hit me one day that these people are not above any one of us. It is time for us to get involved in our local politics, and that's exactly what I did. And in my first run, when I ran for mayor of Tucson, I actually did quite well, and I felt really good about that. I engaged with voters. I helped them understand that what happens here matters, And so I thought, okay, I've done my chomp. And then I decided to run for a supervisor, county supervisor, and I did really quite well, capturing 43% of the vote. And I thought I would hang up my hat, but the good Lord had better intentions for me, and I happened to live in Ward 3. And I know, and I voters need to understand, the council's vote is equal to the mayor's. The mayor has no veto authority. All you simply need is a majority on the council to be that difference. In this election season, voters actually have the chance to vote for me in Ward 3 and vote for Ward 6. And remember that irrespective of where you live in the city, you can vote for Ward 3 and Ward 6. And we need that vote to turn the council around. I heard you talking about fare free transit. Well, the last vote for fare free transit, two of the council members voted to reinstate fares. Now imagine if you had myself and Jay Tolkoff, and I speak only for myself. I know for a fact I would vote to reinstate fares. Then that majority would have taken that vote. So it is very important who you vote for council.
And if you want to learn more about Janet Wendbaker's platform and what things she wants to change, and one of those listed on her website is the fare free transit issue, you can go to janetfortucson.com, and that's J-A-N-E-T F-O-R, not the number four, F-O-R, T-U-S-C-O-N.com to get more information on her. So, JL, you said up front on your website, and you've said it really throughout any of the campaigns that you've run thus far, is your goal is to safeguard our neighborhoods and revitalize our city. So what are some of the key areas that you think you can help by bringing that diversity of thought to the council make that happen?
Primarily with the budget decisions. The city manager will present a budget, and that budget is voted on by the mayor and council. This last budget approval, they allowed for 17% of a $2.4 billion budget, only 17% to go to public safety. Public safety is divided up between police, fire, and emergency services, all of which we need for our safety. And yet they only got 17% in the budget that they had to split up. And that is the place that your council truly can make a decision and be the change. The city government is a city manager strong system. And what that means is the mayor and council establish policy through, again, that majority vote, and the city manager is charged with running the city. The mayor and council appoint the city manager, the city attorney, and the court magistrate, all of which are very important to our safety and making decisions about our safety. The chief of police, the chief of fire are appointed by the city manager, but at the consent of the mayor and council. And that's where you need a common sense council that will make decisions based on the community's safety, not on placating to a certain crowd. And when I talk about placating to that certain crowd, that's where your vote really matters. Because frankly, when only 24% of the Tucson population shows up to vote, the registered voters, only 24% show up to vote in the city elections, and this is historical, consistently across the board, guess what? The mayor and council don't care what the 75% think, right? They just don't care because they don't vote. This is particularly true in Ward 3. Ward 3 has a historically low voter turnout. And consequently, when they decide to create the safe sleeping site, aka Star Village, or a pallet city, or work on their mental housing, it all runs through Ward 3. And so I plead with your listening audience, not just for you to vote, but to get your family members to vote and your friends and everyone you know in the city of Tucson. And that's where you're going to be heard.
We talk about that quite a lot on this show, JL, because we focus on engagement. And for some, their lives are so busy that the only thing they can do on being an engaged citizen is quite often that vote. And they have to take advantage. That's one of our rights and responsibilities in our nation, is to vote and be a responsible voter. So I appreciate you coming on and pressing that issue, because 24% is terrible. 20% in the CD7 race was terrible. It's, to me, those are signs people don't want to be part of the democracy. Let's get back engaged, and people need to get out and vote. So you talked about revitalizing the city and helping, you know, the in public safety area. One of the ones that you have a pretty large section on your website, janetfortucson.com, is on homelessness. Homelessness, drug use, crime, those all appear to be fairly interrelated. Doesn't mean every person that's homeless is committing to is doing those, but there is a segment that is. What's do you think your approach to help all those in that situation is, but specifically maybe on those who are creating loss and trouble within the community?
Yeah, so the city of Tucson has applied a one-prong approach to dealing with homelessness, and that is, well, they just need shelter. These people are down on their luck. They just need shelter. Well, that is not the case with everyone. And as a matter of fact, we know the large majority are on the streets because of a cycle of addiction, which then creates a cycle of crime and criminal behavior. And again, we've seen it on our buses. We've seen it at our bus stops. We see it in our neighborhoods. So it's time for accountability. That accountability needs to happen with prosecuting those criminal charges. Now, Tucson's government structure is complicated in that you have a county attorney that's elected, and that county attorney is responsible for prosecuting those individuals. And that's not happening. Petty theft is not being prosecuted. And what I mean by petty theft is under 900 and some odd dollars. It's simply not prosecuted. We have to have stern approaches to our prosecution, which would also include our city magistrate. But when we talk about the county, if the county's not doing that job, then the council needs to be extremely vocal about calling that individual out. But not only that, by continuing to push in and arrest people for those criminal actions, accountability is key to turning situations around, right? You touch a hot stove, you bam, you know not to touch that hot stove again. You get arrested. You spend time in jail, and hopefully you learn your lesson. If not, you get arrested again. And I say, let's make it easier on those people who are released from incarceration. And I know the Tucson Crime Free Coalition and Humberto Lopez and the Gospel Rescue Mission are doing a great deal to try to ease that transition back into society. But we have to hold those people accountable for their criminal actions. And one of that way also happens is, I don't know if you're aware, the city of Tucson appointed court magistrate has a quarterly warrant forgiveness. So if you have a warrant every quarter, you could just have that warrant forgiven. All you have to do is apply. It's time to start holding people accountable for their actions. If you can't pay the fee associated with whatever caused that warrant, let's put you into community service. Another thing I'd say about the homeless is by trying to treat everyone the same, we're missing the people who could actually receive and accept that help. And when they receive and accept that help, it actually works. So let's prioritize those people, and let's prioritize our elderly and get our individuals who are suffering from mental health traumas, get them into care. But the remainder who just want to participate in criminal activities and ride the bus all day free and take their drugs, it's time to hold them accountable.
Accountability is an important thing in our country, that is for sure. And that's the voice of Janet Wittenbraker, candidate for Tucson City Council Ward 3. We're going to take a quick break, but stay with us. You're listening to 1030 The Voice, trusted local news and talk. Welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice, and I'm Ted Maxwell, and my guest is Janet J.L. Wittenbraker, the Ward 3 Republican candidate for the Tucson City Council. Ballots will get mailed tomorrow. Early voting starts tomorrow, and the elections, I believe, finish on November 4th. We'll get that date for sure before the next one. Jay, I'll appreciate the areas that you talked about beforehand. We've got about a little over 3.5 minutes. I want you to be able to have some time to close, but I've got one question for you. One thing that jumped out at me is you've got a unique position on mayor and council salaries. Do you want to explain what that is?
Well, I believe that the voters were misinformed, if not ill-informed. I think ill-informed is a better term, in that when the vote came up to increase the mayor and council salary, I don't think the voters actually knew that they were basically going to lift the council salary to almost $97,000 a year, and the mayor's council salary to over $125,000 a year. These are, and as a matter of fact, when that proposition came up, even though I was running for mayor, I wrote an argument against it. And my argument is it did not define the mayor and council's hours. As a matter of fact, Kevin Dahl's office is only open 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. Monday through Friday, with it being closed on the first Friday of every month. It also was unreasonably high and well above the median income in Tucson. I argue that this should go back up for a vote, and the mayor and council's salary should match the median income, and thereby incentivizing them to actually bring industry here to Tucson. Tucson has a very high poverty rate, and it's because there is no job competition here. Employers, they get to pick. They're picking from a large group of people, and therefore they can keep Tucson's salaries low. We have to bring big business to Tucson so people have more employment opportunities. So if we put their salaries at the median income, that will incentivize their action, right?
Absolutely. I think that is one of the more creative and one of the ones that makes sense. It's a logical reason to have it tied back to the median salary. So, JL, I want to thank you for joining us today. We're coming up on the end of our hour. If you want more information on Janet Wittenbraker's platform, it's www.janetfortucson, all spelled out, .com. And we wish you the best of luck as you begin the actual election vote receiving phase of this campaign.
Right. And that date, election day, is November 4th.
I was right.
If you're going to... Yes, you were. And we need people to return their ballots as soon as they receive them so we can actually, it's election month, right? So we can actually target our ballot chasing activities.
All right. We wish you the best of luck, and thank you for joining us on The Morning Voice.
Thank you.
Stay with us. We'll be with the Pima County Attorney, Laura Conover, as soon as we get back. Good morning and welcome back. You are listening to The Morning Voice. Thank you for joining us today. 5 days a week, five different hosts, five different flavors, a little bit of politics involved in all of them, some maybe more than others. But on Tuesdays, Matt and I host the Engagement Hour. Our focus is trying to get people involved in their community, get people to stand up and do things. We talked a lot in the first hour about your rights and responsibilities as a voter. City of Tucson voting ballots go out tomorrow. Citywide elections, that means everybody's allowed to vote. Might not agree with that if you believe in direct representation, but everybody's allowed to vote. Don't do it right. Make your voice known and be heard. So we always encourage that kind of engagement. We've talked about it could be first responders, military members, people leading their communities, and elected officials. It takes something special to be willing to stand up to the heat and the pressure of being an elected official. And so I want to thank Laura Conover right from the front for being willing to join me. Laura is the Pima County attorney. You ran for that office the first time in 2000, and so you were sworn into office in 2001. Sorry.
Not nearly that long ago.
No. 2020.
I mean, it feels like it was a generation ago, lifetime ago.
I could understand that.
The before times. It was I filed for office before 4 months before COVID.
Yeah, there's a lot. And I know in the op-ed, and we'll talk about your op-ed here in a little bit, you referenced some of the changes you experienced during COVID and how that changed things. But first, in the first place, made you decide to run for Pima County Attorney?
Well, first of all, Ted, thank you for having me here. Anytime we can just educate more on the system and on the office, I'm always pleased to do that. It's not nearly the mystery it once was, but there's still a lot of education to go for our community. So thank you so much for having me. Why did I do this thing? Why did I run for office? I had, in the last 5 years before running for office, I had opened up my own small law practice, and I had always been kind of a data geek and a policy geek, tracking modernization of the criminal justice system across the country, and in being in private practice and becoming an attorney for victims, for being the third attorney in the room as their legal victim representation, really opened my eyes to the system at large and all the modernization that we could be doing. And that sparked my interest when my predecessor unexpectedly announced that she was retiring.
Well, your first campaign, 4 years, I'd say they were a challenging 4 years between COVID and the impact and the effect that you've kind of outlined in your op-ed. And you want to talk about a little bit that, how COVID kind of changed things and how they're done at the county attorney's office and the impact on prosecutions as well as crime.
Yeah. I knew when I was filing that anyone that was going to attempt to come into that agency from the outside after a 44-year partnership running that office, I knew that was going to be a very daunting task. And then COVID and a violent crime spike, you know, added on to the already uphill challenge. But at the same time, you have to just embrace what you have, and you have to look for the ways in which you can seize opportunity. I knew when I filed that having a paper file system in 2020, like still holding on to a paper file system, was causing some internal problems. And COVID gave me the excuse to kind of fundraise and demand that we go on to an online case management system. I know that sounds simple, but it actually has massive public safety effects. You know, we have to be able to communicate with law enforcement and communicate with our partners statewide. And so, you know, opportunities like that had to be seized. And the other opportunity for sure was to bring in a whole bunch of new staff, new attorneys, new leaders, a whole lot of veterans who had left the office many years ago, and to return and come back and lend their expertise all coming in for that really good intention of serving the community, right? Every single person who works at the Pima County Attorney's Office, Ted, could be doing that same exact job for two or three times the money tomorrow. And that was true during COVID as well. And so every single person who's there is there because they want to be a part of direct service to the community. It's an honor.
Well, that's part of the engagement and getting involved. So I appreciate their service. Now, one of the challenges, and I will just jump to this one. I want to hear what you found as the challenges when you first got there. But one of them you already alluded to, and that is staffing and having enough personnel. And I believe you've got some staffing challenges, or you've got a lot of vacancies right now at the county's attorney's office. Is that become a challenge? Do you see a way out of it? Is it impacting your ability to prosecute cases?
So the good news is that as far as actual prosecutors goes, we are fully staffed up to the full level that the county funds us for. And we're looking for very creative ways to actually push past that. You have to make really hard decisions internally with your budget, and we're doing that to actually push our number.
So you're looking at adding more prosecutors?
Yeah, we're doing it right now. Yeah, we're absolutely adding them on right now. Where we continue to have a real struggle, and every single county department does, is with entry level staff at and around minimum wage. You know, it's what's killing me right now are those Amazon ads. About how much you can make working for Amazon and driving for Amazon right now, because it's significantly more than what our frontline staff can make, and they're dealing with victims calling in who are traumatized, right? This is very, very difficult, sensitive, stressful work. And so I'm so grateful for those that are there, but filling those positions, less than they can make it in an out burger where they're making people happy and listening to fun music. It's hard to fill those positions, and that's true across the county. And we're working on creative ways for that as well.
So, just curiosity, from an impact perspective, what impact do you think those vacancies have on you? Is it with interaction with the community? Is it with the caseload you can take? What impact is, because I think you're still like 74 people short, roughly 21%, 20, somewhere in that ballpark.
That may or may not be accurate. We'll have to pull that. I know that.
It was two weeks ago.
Yeah, but is it, but that's not my document.
No.
Yeah.
Absolutely not.
So we'll, right. No, we'll look into that. But
you've got two lines in this thing, Pima County for grants and for local. So those were the local numbers.
Which is why that never comes out accurately. It's something that the county keeps retracting for us. So I'll have to bring that up again.
I'll make sure I talk to the administrator about that.
She knows that's been causing me problems repeatedly. Nevertheless, what we find is that we have to lean into paralegals who we'd rather be doing high-level, high-skilled work, helping with things like redaction. The amount of body-worn camera footage that we have to redact in office is daunting, and it's draining. Right, it's critical work because you're protecting the identities of victims, and you're redacting sensitive information off of files, but off of recordings before they're disclosed further out. But it's critical work, but it's draining work, and I'd rather have the paralegals doing more direct casework.
So let's stick on the concept of what it is to be the county attorney, because it's not, I think you've told me you don't actually prosecute cases personally. You're more in the supervisory role on doing, running the office.
Right.
So what is your role as the county attorney in, let's say, the prosecutor, the prosecutorial, if that's a word, process?
Mm-hmm.
How much do you get involved in setting the working the pleas, or how much do you involve in getting with the charges, or how much do you determine? What's your level of extent of determining what goes to court and what doesn't?
Oh, it's absolutely zero. Right. It's 380 employees. It's a $42 million budget. I'm the supervisor of like the largest law firm. I'm just the administrator of like the largest law firm in Southern Arizona. And when we talk about precious resources and obligations, I'm also the county's attorney. So we provide the legal advice to every single county department, every contract that runs through Pima County. We're the legal advisors to every single department. We're the legal advisor to the Board of Supervisors, to the county administrator herself. We have a small detectives, and I say small, but it's mid-level in Tucson. We have a group of 22 detectives working. We run 88 crime. We have a juvenile division. We have courthouses where a prosecutor lives in Ajo. We have another courthouse in Green Valley. It's 1.1 million people and 9,000 square miles. So no, I am not able to carry a caseload. And I know that that surprises people, but that would be a shocking abdication of the actual responsibilities and duties. Now, the one place where I'm in the room is called the homicide panel. And that runs every Monday. Four or five active homicides are presented in a formal presentation. It's a huge think tank. Usually most of the TPD homicide detectives unit is there because the assigned detectives are in the room. And it's some collective of 300 years of trial experiences in the room to get fair outcomes for every single homicide. So instead of individual prosecutors behind a closed door making their own wise decision on a case, we make sure that it's a collective decision to really drive towards the most fair outcomes that we can. Not to mention strategizing. You know, what's going to do well in front of a jury and what's not, because you've got that, again, 300 years of collective trial work and wisdom in the room.
Okay, so that makes sense on the homicide panel, and that's why I know when I talk to you, you can't do Mondays ever on the radio.
Right,
so
that's challenging, right, yeah.
Because you've got that panel. So that's a collective effort. Are there any other levels of crimes where you also use that collective mentality? Or at this point, are you having to trust that your direction is being carried out by the folks that are working in your office?
Well, so first of all, and I want to give credit to my predecessor. The homicide panel is a best practice for that fairness, and we've been expanding that model further. So I want to mention that when I arrived, we were at 2020, the year before I arrived, we were in an extraordinary violent crime spike, and right now, as of last week, homicides are now down from that peak 46%. It's a 46% reduction in homicides. And so each one that happens that garners so much media attention, one homicide is one too many. That, you know, that's the lofty goal, right?
Right.
But we're in a 46% reduction. So now we've started a shoot meet where, this is also TPD-led, where we're looking at non-fatal shootings and moving the model into there. And I think that's actually happening right now as we speak. It's a Tuesday morning thing. But of course, those are my subject matter experts. When you're running an operation as big as 380 employees and 42 million, you know, Ted, you know, from both business and the military, you can't touch everything. I mean, if you don't trust your people, you're lost in the world.
there's no doubt you have to trust your people. And at the same time, whether it's good or bad, the person at the top gets to answer all the questions. So I appreciate you being here.
Oh, 100%.
And I know you know that. And we're going to go to a quick break. I've got some follow-ups, and we'll continue this conversation.
Great.
So that's the voice of Laura Conover, Pima County attorney. And we'll be right back. You're listening to 1030 The Voice, your trusted local news and talk station. Welcome back. Thank you for staying with us. I'm Ted Maxwell. This is The Morning Voice. Matt Neely behind the glass, keeping us on time and on target, as always. And Laura, I appreciate you joining us today. Laura Conover, the Pima County attorney, is with us today. And we've been talking a lot about the structure within the organization, you know, the challenges, three large organization, a lot going on. I guess one of the questions that I've got is, you mentioned when I reached out to you in preparation with this, that you face almost 10,000 felonies a year. Is that high? Is that roughly in that vicinity, charges? So it could be multiple charges for a single case, but
yeah. And I appreciate you mentioning that, Ted. So about 10,000 felonies will get presented and come in, and I really want to try to explain this because it's surprising to people. The national charging rate always hovers at around 50%. And what that means is that about half of what law enforcement brings into DA offices across the nation, district attorney offices across the nation, actually gets charged and turns into an open felony prosecution. And that's not a judgment on law enforcement. It's the design of the entire system. The law enforcement standard is to quickly disrupt harm in front of them, right? So it's a low standard called probable cause. Is it more likely than not? Is it like 51-49 that I'm looking at, you know, a possible crime here? Just disrupt immediately, disrupt the harm. Then, you know, we have the luxury of time, and in an office later in time, we sort through, you know, they present evidence to us, we sort it through, and we have to ask whether there is a substantial likelihood that a Pima County jury will convict this as a felony. And you've got issues with witnesses, you've got issues with capturing evidence, we've got to look at whether there were any violations of the Constitution or other kinds of rights, memories, you know, the witness's ability to really perceive what they were seeing. You know, frankly, a case could look very, very strong in that moment and then start to fall apart through no one's fault at all. We lose witnesses. We lose the eyewitness sometimes.
You're actually hitting on that was probably the line that got my attention.
Yeah.
Was the one that the substantial likelihood to convict.
Right, right.
And so of those 10,000 cases or however many, I don't know how many cases, 10,000 charges, what is the percentage in the Pima County that actually go to trial or result in charges?
I guess it's the same here as it is across the nation. Okay. It's about 50%. And that's because that's the design of the system. And that's hard for some people to hear or wrap their minds around. The you're talking about liberty and the lifelong consequences of having been branded a felon for life. And so the whole design of the American system from the get-go is the idea that it is better to let 10 guilty men go free lest we accidentally incarcerate an innocent man. Like, that's the concept. And that, you know, that's hard for everyone to grasp and agree with, but it's the way we protect our rights, and it's how we live in a democracy rather than a police state or a military state. And so that's how it goes. I will tell you, Ted, of course, it varies between divisions a little bit. There are some types of crime that are likely to literally be captured on video, right? And we don't even need a witness to come in, and you know, we've got the whole moments, the key moments in time captured on camera. Versus, I'll give you an example. Over half of domestic violence victims, over half, are not participating by the time those cases go to trial. Put another way, we are often in domestic violence trials where the victim is not supporting the prosecution or in fact is assisting the defense and the defense attorney. Talk about a tall order. So the work is hard.
and that kind of gets to why that line jumped at me, though, because substantial, I always try to do some research as best you can do on AI and online, you know, and it talks reasonable. I understand that you don't want to waste taxpayers' time, money, effort going to trial if it's not going to stand up. Sometimes just the fact of going to trial in and amongst it may deter follow-on actions by somebody who's not going to trial, who's getting out of it. even if it's difficult. So who makes those calls? Who's the one that determines if something goes to trial or doesn't?
So this is really fascinating, Ted. So the concept of general deterrence, which is what you just laid out there, is the idea that someone might pause on the street and think to themselves, well, the Pima County Attorney's Office in the last 8 weeks just convicted 5 first-degree murder cases. That's true. That guy running down the street high on substances, the data's not good that says that he's going to somehow even know anything about that in whatever's fueling his actions right now. It's definitely not going to cause him to pause and think about...
I understand.
Right. But that's, again, that's the concept of general deterrence, and some right. people really push for that. What I will tell you also is that going to trial is number one, the most expensive thing you could possibly do with taxpayer money. And it's the riskiest because it's asking 12 right. people to vote, right? Whereas a plea agreement ensures the felony conviction, ensures accountability, ensures a punishment. They give up their appeal rights.
Great lead. And you just set a hook for me on the next topic.
Oh, good.
We'll never get through all the things that I was hoping for us to talk about in this time frame because it just flies. But when we come back, let's talk about that. Let's talk sure. about plea agreements.
Sure.
And what message they send to the community.
Certainty.
Okay.
Certainty and assurance.
That's the voice of Laura Conover, the Pima County attorney. We will be right back after the break. Okay. We good now? Matt? Yep. It sounds. I can hear my voice. For a while there, it went away. That's good. All right. Sorry about that.
Sorry.
You never know what happens on the radio. It's live radio.
Well, Ted, it's not recorded. I just learned we're on video. So I have to apologize for my allergy face and voice. Sorry.
That was my fault. I should you know that up front. It's something new we're doing here at the Morning Voice. And if you want to take a quick look up to the side, there you go. That's where we can see it.
Thanks, Pat.
So let's go. You open up the conversation about pleas. That is probably the one thing that hits the press more than anything is plea bargains that result. And Tim Steller's had multiple articles lately talking about repeat offenders and gun crimes and pleaing some of those down to misdemeanors. I had a personal touch on a friend of ours whose nephew was shot by somebody who was out on a weapon charge that was pled down to basically weapons misconduct. Who is it and why does it seem that's... I know the press is the press and they want to take it, but especially when it comes to gun violence, why is it that that is something that we hear about plea agreements?
So I guess moving backwards, first of all, you can always take, you know, the 572 cases, gun possession cases from last year, and you can cherry pick 4 or 5 and complain about them.
In Steller's article, right. he argues it's more like 200 because you released... There were some dropped and changed, and he took it all the way down to 200.
Well, right, because that's the charging rate, right? We've got to have... Remember, we want police to disrupt, and then in a jury trial, we've got... The jury instruction is beyond a reasonable doubt, right? It's the standard is you know, twice as high as what it is for law enforcement, and that, as it should be. Plea agreements give assurance and certainty is what we were saying earlier. A jury of our peers can do anything they want once the evidence has been presented. When a defendant agrees to be held accountable, to have a felony conviction on their record, to go off to prison, you know, and to make restitution to a victim, and give up all their appeal rights, you know, that's the work that you need most cases to plea in order to make sure the community is safe, and to get that assurance of accountability rather than rolling the dice in front of a jury trial. Now, we still do that constantly. The courts are full of four or five trials every single week, and those are all ours. Those are all our prosecutors, which is why you need the rest of the work to be handled through an agreement to have a conviction. And that's how we assure safety. We have, 9 or 10 different divisions within the criminal division, and each one with a veteran supervisor, to make sure that there's, incredible supervision going on.
Have you provided any guidance to them on pleas? I mean, what role are you ever brought into the plea discussion, or how does that play?
Again, with some 10,000 cases being presented, no, I don't touch individual cases. I think that might almost be strange, or again, an abdication of the rest of my duties. Now, I will say that there are very, very difficult choices that sometimes come down. And so sometimes, a non homicide or a really difficult charging decision might come into the homicide panel, so that, again, all those 300 years of wisdom can weigh in on just a really difficult, like, can we charge this or can we not? But that's by far the exception. They get excellent training. I'm thrilled with our in-house trainer, and excellent supervision, so that they can bounce ideas around off each other and get the best result possible.
Right. I think that's one of the challenges, from the public: one too many crimes committed by somebody who's either out on pretrial services or in a situation where they've had previous gun weapons charges particularly.
Well, and I'll tell you, Ted, that has been a point of concern between the sheriff and the chief and I my entire time in office, is that we still feel like the initial appearance process does not work as well as it should. It goes, this is the first hearing after someone's arrest. It flies at rapid speed. There's very little information in front of everyone, because it's moving so fast. We make the best arguments we can on what's called our ongoing threat of harm analysis. Is this person before us, are we concerned? It's a 28-point factor of, are they a concern? We make the best argument, and then the judges decide on release or detention. And they also decide on cash bail. I'm always going to mention that I think that's a completely flawed system. We just sent a gentleman to life in prison with no possibility of release. He will die in prison. And when he committed a double homicide, he was on release for a previous shooting because he paid that. It was a $50,000 bond. He had the money. He was a businessman and walked right back out to commit another shooting.
And I think that's the challenge that we've got as people. Those are the stories that make it. And it seems far too many of them, too many, especially on the gun charges.
It's deeply frustrating. And the problem is like, what does cash have anything to do with it? You can commit a very violent crime. You can be accused of committing a very violent crime. And if you have the money, you just walk right back out. We have one right now where the accused in a homicide paid a bond of 50 grand, went out and picked up a DUI charge, then they upped it to 75 grand, and the community paid it again. And because if it's cash, it's cash. You just pay it and get out.
Well, I think there's probably a lot of support in the community for folks who don't have the opportunity to get out. And I know we've talked before in the past when you first came into office about the challenge you had with judges getting out. I want to go to another sensitive topic a little bit.
Sure, they all
and
are.
I know.
That's my job.
That's right. That's true. That's right. A good point. There's been several cases of sexual misconduct with a minor that was the person who was charged or brought in for it was in a position of trust
or care.
Positions of trust, care, a teacher, an official in a church. Several of those have been done with long-term pleas, so long-term probation, but not necessarily always with the registration of as a sexual predator. So I kind of curious on to me, I understand the long-term predation. They may not be a danger to the public, but they're a danger to another segment. If we don't use that second half of it, I guess that's one of those ones when you see it, it just doesn't make sense.
Ted, I have to tell you, I think I've only heard of that once or twice in my 5 years. And again, we're talking about thousands of cases. What I'll tell you, Ted, is that in the vast majority of those cases, a harm has been committed and the family and the community rallies around the victim. The evidence is there and it's strong. And there's convictions either by plea agreements or there's a lot of trials on these cases because of our concern about ongoing threat of harm. So there are opportunities within the special victims unit to not offer pleas at all if we're concerned about a lifetime possibility of harm. And then I'll tell you that there are also cases similar in the domestic violence unit where the victim and maybe the family is assisting the defense and the defendant. And we don't have, so we do not have the key witness. We don't have any of that testimony. We have to go with whatever was captured at the time and then fight the uphill battle. And if instead we can get that sex-based felony conviction, then we've got that assurance that we've got the felony conviction. It's going to lead to a lifetime of consequences. It's going to create huge pockets of employment that's never going to be open to them, et cetera, et cetera. Yes, there are always going to be rare cases and then the thousands of other convictions.
So real quick, because we've got to unfortunately stop this conversation, because I told you, time flies.
Absolutely.
It goes incredibly fast. We've talked a lot about, you know, I'm talking about the ones we hear about.
Sure.
You said the number of prosecutions are huge. Is there a data site that the county attorney's office that keeps that shows by charge and something, you know, weapons related? Is, because if there's not, where the public can go to it and see what actually is done, it's something I would highly encourage you to consider.
It's part of our move to the online case management system. I would really defend the previous administration that if you're on a paper file system, then trying to run data is very, very hard. So they had a paper file system and we're not producing any data at all. That's our goal, is part of moving on to the online case management system is to create reliable databases. But that's the last piece of getting there. And we're getting there now.
Well, I want to thank you for being willing to come on. I hope you'd be willing to come on again.
Absolutely.
You know, because I think this is important for the public to hear, and there it's important. Your role in the community is important for them to hear your thoughts on how things are going. And maybe next time we'll even get a little bit more on some incredible radio.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right. Thanks, Ted.
That's the voice of Laura Conover, the Pima County Attorney. Thank you for joining us today. Stay with us. We'll be right back with our friends from RJP Estate Planning. Welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Ted Maxwell. Matt Neely's behind the glass, keeping us on time and target. And tomorrow morning on The Morning Voice, you'll have Grant Kruger with Food for Thought. So please tune in, continue to support The Morning Voice crew. We enjoy having you with us either during your drive time or your time at home. We just appreciate knowing you're out there listening. So thanks again. So question for you today. Do you have an estate plan that protects you while you're alive and when you pass away? Think about this. If you were in a serious accident or had a sudden illness and couldn't speak for yourself, who would make decisions about your medical care or your money? Without a plan, your family could end up in court fighting over your future. That's why we're joined today by Chris Cohan from RJP Estate Planning, helping Arizonans protect their families for over 35 years. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Ted. How are you?
Doing well today. Let's start with what happens if someone is alive, but they can't make their decisions.
Yeah, Ted. So this is something that most people don't think about. You know, a will only works after you die. While you're alive, if you can't make decisions, the court may step in to appoint someone to make your decisions for you. Last year, Arizona had over 121,000 car accidents reported. And more than 1,200 of those were fatal. Imagine you survive an accident but can't speak or make decisions, doctors would follow Arizona's priority list to decide who would make decisions if you can't. First your spouse, then your adult children, then your parents. But what if your family disagrees? The court could appoint a neutral stranger to make your long-term care decisions.
And it's not just for medical care, correct? It's your finances can get tied up in this as well?
Exactly. Without a living trust, your family may not be able to manage your money right away. They might have to go to court, which can cost time and money. Like a financial power of attorney can help, letting someone you trust pay your bills, access your bank accounts, and handle your finances. But even with a financial power of attorney, some assets may still need court approval. That's why most estate planners recommend both a living trust to protect your assets and avoid court, and a financial power of attorney to handle day-to-day finances while you're alive.
Well, that's important to know. How can people stay in control while they're alive?
So by creating a complete estate plan, like at RJP Estate Planning, we help you set up a living trust, which protects your assets and finances if you become incapacitated, and keeps your estate out of probate court after you pass away, and your assets pass smoothly to your loved ones. And a medical power of attorney lets you pick who makes your medical decisions if you can't. Also, a financial power of attorney lets someone handle your bills and finances right away. Healthcare directives and a living will tells your family what kind of medical care you want. With these documents, your family can act right away. Your wishes are followed, and the court doesn't get involved.
Those documents, they seem very powerful if you find yourself in that situation. And you mentioned probate. That's another area that can catch families off guard, correct?
Yes. So a will doesn't avoid probate. It guarantees it. That means that public court filings and potentially long delays for your family and hefty legal fees to settle your estate. So a living trust lets your assets transfer privately and quickly, saving time, money, and stress.
So a properly done estate plan protects you while you're alive and when you pass away.
Exactly. Without one, bills could go unpaid, property can fall into foreclosure, and families can spend months in court. With an estate plan, families can act immediately to care for you and handle your finances while you're still alive. And when you pass away, your assets bypass probate and are passed on to your family.
And RJP does more than just prepare those documents. You provide both the tools and the support as well.
Yes. Every client gets a power of attorney ID cards for their wallet, so first responders know who to contact. At RJP Estate Planning, we also provide a secure USB drive with all of your documents for quick access. Through our Guiding Hearts division, we help families find assisted living, memory care, or independent living. We arrange tours, handle paperwork, and guide families through the process. And after you pass away, RJP provides free settlement support for your loved ones. We walk them through every step on how to settle your estate and receive their inheritance.
That's amazing support. Listeners, a properly done estate planning protects you while you're alive and when you pass away. If you don't have one or yours is outdated, now's the time to make sure everything in your estate plan is up to date. Call RJP Estate Planning at 520-441-4523 to schedule your free strategy meeting. Right now, if you're over 55, you can save 55% on a living trust package, but only if you call by this Thursday, October 9th. Again, that's 520-441-4523. Don't leave your family unprotected. Call today and let RJP Planning help you plan for your life's whens and protect against life's what-ifs. Call 520-441-4523. Chris, as always, we appreciate your insight, and thanks for sharing these critical details about why we all need a proper estate plan.
Thanks, Ted. I appreciate your time.
All right, Chris, you have a good day, and we'll talk to you soon.
Look forward to it. Bye now.
All right, take care. Well, Matt, we had a pretty interesting show today.
Indeed.
That definitely got some...
Covered a lot of ground.
A lot of ground. Talked a lot about the city of Tucson.
Right.
Obviously, I'd say we just scratched the surface with Pima County Attorney Conover. Hopefully, we'll get her to come back in and we can dive a little bit more into some of the details. I've still got a ton of questions despite having her on. It's amazing how fast this time flows.
Indeed.
All right. Well, everybody, appreciate you listening and being part of the conversation with us. Stay tuned for Kathleen Wynn on Wynn Tucson, and make sure every morning from 7 to 9, you're turning in to listen to The Morning Voice. Everybody have a great week, and I look forward to next week with you.
And don't forget, Grant Krueger will be on tomorrow. He'll be the host on Wednesday, and food for thought. So we always look forward to that. Have a good day, Ted.